You're going to be handcuffed outside of the ring to the total package, Lex Luger.
Please, Lex, listen to me. It's not too late. We don't have to be handcuffed together, baby.
Oh, you've dribbled all over the floor. You've made a fool of yourself.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Have you ever heard a young man called Hector Singan van Dalsken Alkadenai Alex Mimulten Gaitan?
Never. I've never heard of that name. What? Is that his last name?
Well, he went on by that until I got a hold of him, and now you probably know him as a man called Sting!
Wow, the Stinger! Mom! Dad, it's really him!
That's Sting from the top of the United Center!
But the only thing that's for sure about Sting is nothing's for sure.
Grab your plunder and open the pay window. It's time for Survey Says.
Welcome to the third edition of Survey Says. It's going to be an awesome show tonight. As we are live from the rafters at the United Center in Chicago, we have a huge show. It is going to be all about Sting, and that's why we're in the rafters, because this is actually the site of the first time that Sting, he descended from the rafters. And up here in the rafters with me, I've got my great, good companion, Tim, and our first guest ever on the show, Greg Phillips. How are you guys doing?
Great, Andy, and really looking forward to this show. It's our first three-man booth, so that's very exciting. I'm really proud and honored to have the esteemed Greg Hitman Clark Phillips joining us tonight. He's from the Place to Be Nation Comics Contingent, as we call it, one half of the hard-traveling fanboys with Nick Duke, and he always travels hard. Greg, how are you doing, my man?
I'm doing great. I couldn't ask for a better intro than that. And, you know, it's just my pleasure to be sitting here in the rafters as part of a three-man booth in the great WCW tradition of three-man booths. And I'd have to say, I mean, I would definitely be the Stagger Lee Marshall of our group.
Stagger Lee Marshall, the women's wrestling expert. That really fits you well. That's what I think of when I hear the name Greg Phillips.
So, absolutely. I've just gotten a weasel sighting.
God rest his soul, right? And that brings the temperature down a little. Now, this is the show that Place to Be Nation Svengali Supreme, JT Rosero, recently described as beautifully innocent. I almost called him a Svengooli. That would have been a problem. So I'm just wondering if tonight is the night that we lose our innocence. I feel like we won't, since we're talking Sting, but you never know. I mean, Greg, you're a man with a checkered past. You're quite a colorful character. So I'm not too sure where the night's going to lead us. Thank you for joining. It's really a privilege to have you on board.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. My pleasure. I am from the Deep South, and thus I am a dyed-in-the-wool WCW fanatic. So it's really exciting for me to be on the show.
Yeah, so now actually have a WCW fan instead of just me and Tim being jackasses and making fun of everybody.
Well, I do a little bit of that too. But.
And doing a Starcade rundown and not covering all the Starcades. So, with apologies to Starcades 86 and 87, which either got glossed over or not mentioned entirely.
You guys had to sit through Flair and Race again?
Yeah. You know, I was okay with that for a Starcade.
The show is really good, but man, that main event is so slow.
It really is. And I would just have to apologize to the nation for severely shortchanging Starcade 85. That's really a much better show than I think we gave it credit for. You know, there's blade jobs galore, maybe.
blood in every match might be a little
but it's excessive. A good show. But it really is a good show. It's just, it's hard to watch those things like back-to-back marathon style as we did. Andy, I don't know if this was your experience, but I feel like had we had the luxury of spacing them out, we we might have come away with some better impressions of certain shows than others. But yeah, the early 80s Starcades, unfortunately, kind of blurred together in my mind, and unfairly so in the case of that 85 show, which I think really is a standout. So I did want to set the record straight just a little bit on that, because I watched part of it again and I was like, oh, wow, I feel bad about not giving this its props.
I make no apologies for my behavior and my comments. I'm good with it.
Good. I'll do all the apologizing for us.
Much like in our comics podcasts.
But not to belabor the point, we're not here to talk about Starcade tonight. We are here to talk the man known as the man from every man's nightmare, man called Sting. Now, Greg, I feel like Andy and I are not big Sting guys. Andy, is that a fair assessment?
For me, I would say that I was, and then I've kind of cooled on him, and but now I'm kind of coming back around. So maybe I'm the middle guy in this.
Okay. Interesting. We can get into that. I have never been big on Sting in the first place, so I can't say I really cooled on him, but I've been warming up and just watching some of the matches preparing for this show. I feel like I'm going to be the maybe the devil's advocate and addressing any criticisms, perhaps, as we go through the career of Sting, some of the great memories and matches that he's had. But before we really delve into that, Greg, you being our first guest, we want to kind of get your WCW secret origin, if you will. Andy and I shared ours in our pilot episode, so anytime we have a guest on, I think we'd like to go through and see where they stand with respect to WCW, how they came into the promotion. And if that relates to Sting, great, dovetail right in. If not, no big deal. But what brought you to WCW as a fan, Greg?
Well, you know, I listened to the two of your secret origins about your WCW fandom. And I think what kind of makes mine a little bit different is that you two both kind of started out preferring the WWF, and, you know, WCW was kind of the, not the foreign territory, but just kind of like this different thing that was not necessarily equal to. And for me, it was a little bit different because I grew up in South Alabama and South Florida, and down in this section of the country, the NWA was huge. I mean, that was, you know, it was Florida, it was Georgia, it was the Carolinas. These were the territories that people around here just, you know, died for, basically, lived and died for. And for me, I was born into kind of parents that both liked wrestling. So from my earliest memories of life are of, you know, being in the living room watching Gordon Solie or watching Vince McMahon on the weekends. You know, I watched both the WWF and the different NWA territories that we had. So I was really, really pretty much into the WCW territory as it would become from a very, very early age. Like, probably the earliest memories I can have of it are about maybe age three, age four. I remember the buildup to the very first Clash of the Champions. And it's interesting because it does tie into Sting, because my earliest WCW memories are of Sting and Ric Flair having in-ring or having confrontations leading into that Clash match on TBS. And the first time that I laid eyes on Sting, I don't remember what match it was or what promo it was, but I do vividly remember he was the wrestler that stood out to me more than anybody else when I was a little boy. Yeah, you know, obviously, like every little boy at that time, I was a huge Hulk Hogan fan, but Sting to me even stood out for to a different level. It was the spiked hair, the face paint, the physique, just the kind of raw charisma that he always exuded. From pretty much age four, I was like, "That's my guy." Like, that is my guy. Like, Hulk Hogan's awesome. The Ultimate Warrior's cool, but that's my guy. Like, that's the dude I believe in. That's the superhero that I think can beat anybody. You know, that was my ride or die, as they say. So, and it stayed like that pretty much from the rest of my wrestling fandom. I was a Sting fan from day one, and you know, in later years, I cooled on Hulk Hogan, I cooled on the Ultimate Warrior. You know, I discovered Bret Hart, who became my favorite wrestler. But through it all, like, I never lost my Sting fandom. There was never a time in his career where I, even when he went through his rough patches, like the Wolfpack days, I never stopped loving Sting. Like, he was my dude. And I think for the people around here, my friends, people I went to school with, Sting was almost all of our guy. Like, he was just, for us, he was our Hulk Hogan. He was our superhero, our guy that if he came out on TV, on TBS, on Saturday night, and he said, "The sky is red," we were going to believe him. Like, he was that, that's how much we believed in him.
Well, that's exactly what I was hoping for, because it sounds like your first WCW memories, your first wrestling memories, are really Sting memories. So that works out quite nicely for this program. You know, I guess Andy and I ought to share our experiences with Sting as well, how we sort of first got exposed to him. So Andy, why don't you go first? Where, do you remember, like, specifically the first time you saw Sting, or when he kind of initially registered for you as you were watching WCW, you know, apart from just the origin stories that we've already shared?
I can't remember exactly, but I want to say it was a videotape, and it actually might have been Beach Blast. It was 93, I think, the one with the tag team, the Masters of the Powerbomb. Yeah, because I really didn't know what WCW was, but I knew British Bulldog was on the cover, so I think that's why I grabbed that one.
With the fantastic mini-movie leading into that. I'm not sure exactly where I came in on Sting either. I was always kind of vaguely aware of him as a presence, to the extent that I was aware of WCW, since my attention was mostly occupied by WWF. So it's not like I knew a lot of WCW guys, but I knew who Ric Flair was, and I pretty much knew who Sting was. I kind of just viewed him as the WCW version of Hulk Hogan, just that big, larger-than-life, colorful, charismatic national superstar that Hogan was. I sort of saw Sting as maybe not being on the same level, but only because I didn't perceive WCW as being on the same level as the WWF. But I knew who he was. I knew he was a big deal in WCW, but I didn't really see Sting matches until, gosh, really, I guess 1998, because my WCW proper intro was Starrcade 97. That was his big comeback. And 98 was not a tremendously stellar year for Sting in ring
or no,
behind the scenes. And that, I think, has maybe colored some of my opinion about the guy, and maybe unfairly so. So I'm sort of trying to bring it back around and gain an appreciation for these things that maybe if I wasn't there on the ground floor as a more well-rounded wrestling fan, so to speak, nowadays, maybe I can find some joy in. So you mentioned that first Clash match with Flair. I didn't see that match for the first time until really just a few years ago in its entirety. Maybe sounds blasphemous in some circles, but I do really, really, really love that match, I have to say. The first time I saw it and really sat down and watched the whole thing, I was like, oh, this is why Sting and Sting Flair as a rivalry was such a big deal.
Yeah.
I'd certainly seen subsequent matches between the two of them, but they were kind of like the greatest hits version of that match. You know, they were very compressed. They went through the same spots, but kind of, it was like a speed race version of it. So it was easy to take later matches that they had for granted, even though they were always pretty decent. I don't think anything.
Their baseline was good. I mean, that was like good. that was the bottom line of their rivalry. Even that last match on the last Nitro was not bad for 2001 Ric Flair.
Right. He didn't even want to take his shirt off.
Take his shirt off.
Felt so bad about his appearance. Poor Flair. Would you rate that as, for me, I have it in my top of Sting Flair matches. I think that is my favorite, and I don't think that's a controversial opinion by any stretch.
No.
But do you think there's a better Sting Flair encounter?
You know, it's hard to say better because that's always a special one because of what it represented, that it kicked off the rivalry. And it was 45-minute draw and all that good stuff. I think there are some that probably have a little bit more special memory for me. Great American Bash 90, where Sting won the title, is kind of, to me, an underrated match. I think a lot of people, because Sting was coming off an injury, he wasn't maybe quite as explosive as he was right before the injury. But I love that match and the just visceral crowd reaction, like from an emotional connection standpoint, that's the one for me, because I'll never forget like watching TBS and seeing them show the highlights and showing that Sting had won the match, because we couldn't watch pay-per-views in those days. And and I remember seeing the highlights and JR announcing, "Ladies and gentlemen, you have got to see this footage from this past week at the Great American Bash." And they cut to the footage, and when Sting does the roll-up thing, which to me was a novel spot at the time, the figure four reversal, and I was like, oh my god. And the pop when Sting won was amazing. And as far as actual work, I think their Clash of the Champions 94 match, the unification match, is really, really good and kind of sneaky good. A lot of people are mixed on that match, and I get it, because of the Sherry interference and other stuff, but I really dig that. I really dig that match a lot. And they had some other really good ones here, but those would be the three that stand out the most in my memory as being significant from a work perspective.
Okay. Andy, where are you on Sting and Flair while we're talking Flair matches? You know, not to get off on a tangent, but I'm probably going to get off on a tangent here, so feel free to interrupt. Part of my argument, so to speak, coming into this episode, and Andy, you'll remember this, is I was kind of thinking about Sting and thinking great Sting matches, and I was like, well, you know what? Take away Ric Flair, take away Vader, take away Cactus Jack, take away Muda, and then I realized like he had a lot more really good opponents than I had ever I think considered. And I was like, I came up with five or six guys that if you took away those matches, what were you left with? And then I thought, maybe that's not the best standard to hold somebody to, because how many?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at Vader and you take away Sting and Cactus Jack, what are you left with? In America, I mean.
Yeah. And plus, how many great wrestlers really had that many different great opponents, in all honesty? There are the outliers like Shawn and maybe Savage. You know, Flair could work a three-star match with a broom, as they said, but I think they're really the outliers. But when you get right down to it, I mean, Austin didn't have that many great opponents. He had certainly tons, a plethora of great matches, but he kind of had a certain circle of guys that he worked with, that he clicked with really well, and that's to take nothing away from him as a performer. And I kind of realized that about Sting too, and maybe talked myself out of that argument. But Andy, again, just taking it back to Sting and Flair, do you have a favorite of that series, or are you maybe not as high on those matches as we are?
Well, now you went on a big tangent, and I got a lot to say, but I'll just stick with the I'll stick with the Sting versus Flair, because that was the topic. And I really like the one that Greg mentioned from 94 where they unified the belts. But then there's one that kind of always stuck out in my mind as being kind of I don't know if it was really great, but it was one that was memorable to me. And it was Flair and Sting at World War III. Because I just remember Flair running around to the other rings, like backing away from him.
That's a pay-per-view that's not held in high esteem, but it did produce some decent singles matches here and there. We'll take a look at that pay-per-view series at some point. That'd be a nice layup for us, I think.
And that was the follow-up to Halloween Havoc 95, where Flair had once again for about the 900th time turned on Sting. And
I think, I'm glad you mentioned that. I think that's my favorite Flair turn on Sting.
It was a great turn. I mean, because they spent weeks hyping it, where Sting was like, I don't trust you. I don't trust you. It'll never happen. Nope, not going to happen. And then Flair kept allowing himself to be put in vulnerable situations. And Sting, the good guy that he is, the good-hearted person that he is, finally, his resolve cracks. And he says, all right, but if you screw me, If you swerve me, I'm gonna get you, or something like that. And damn it, he swerved him.
Right. Yep. So, and I mean, they telegraphed it so much, but it worked.
It's so great.
And it, of course, led to the reformation of the Horsemen in a not my favorite version of the Horsemen, but I think a pretty strong, if short-lived, iteration.
Mm-hmm. So. That rivalry between Flair and Sting, you know, a lot of people, like, they relate their wrestling fandom to Hogan versus Savage or to Austin versus Rock, and I get that. Those are great rivalries. But for me, a lot of my wrestling fandom can be traced to Flair and Sting. It was the first feud that I really – I mean, I remember some of the earlier Hogan feuds, like Hogan and Andre and stuff like that. But the first feud that I really, like, felt like I had a personal stake in was Flair and Sting, and the fact that they feuded pretty much nonstop for what, 13 years, 12 years, like on in different iterations. Like they
just off and on.
It was pretty cool. I mean, that's why it was such a poetic end to Nitro for that to be the last match on the in the company for WCW, because those were the two guys that I still define WCW by.
Yeah, it really just bookended that show. I mean, go start with Flair Sting, go out with Flair Sting.
Yep.
So, you know, it's really fitting.
Come to think of it, didn't they start that show with an actual bookend from Booker T?
I believe so, because he won the title back from Steiner, didn't he?
Yep.
Now, Greg, so
quite literally. What'd you say, Andy?
I have a question for Greg about your secret origin. When we shared our origins, like how we started watching it, was there any major shows that you attended that were WCW, like pay-per-views or tapings or anything?
Not when I was a little kid, in the late 80s, early 90s. Just for everyone out there listening, I'm 32, so I was born in 84. So, you know, these earliest memories I'm talking about are like 88, 89. I went to my first live wrestling event was a WCW event, and that was 1990. In Mobile, Alabama, I saw a house show that it was from the brief tenure that Bam Bam Bigelow had when he came back in 1990. And it was like what I call the Dudes with Attitudes era, where it was like Paul Orndorff and all of Sting's friends from the Great American Bash 90 time slot. And I can't for the life of me remember what the main event was, but Sting was there and JYD and Orndorff, and, you know, it was a bunch of the older WWF guys who were there at the time. And then, you know, you had your Arn Anderson and your, you know, Rock and Roll Express or whoever. And then I went to another WCW house show in 93 where I got my awesome Sting t-shirt, the Many Faces of Sting. And on that show, he wrestled, it might have been 92, he wrestled the Super Invader on that show.
Oh, who, that was Hercules, wasn't who, it?
Hercules Hernandez, yep. Yeah. And I do remember it was not a very good match, but he did his best. But I remember that. But I actually did go to a major, my first pay-per-view I ever went to was Uncensored 98 at the Mobile Civic Center. Yep.
Now we're talking.
Yep. This was Scott Hall versus Sting for the world title. This was Age in the Cage between the Hulkster and or Hollywood, I should say, and the Macho Man. This was Raven versus DDP versus Chris Benoit in the United States title triangle match that was really good. Chris Jericho at the height of his powers versus Dean Malenko, complete with Mean Gene after the match saying, "Dean Malenko, you, sir, are a bona fide loser." And that was great.
Sends him home. Yep.
Yeah, so that's kind of like my fondest live WCW memory was that show, because I never thought I'd go to a wrestling pay-per-view. I never thought I'd get a chance because they didn't come to where I was very often. And so to get to see Uncensored with my best friend at the time, and my family was with me, it was just really cool. I got to see Sting and Bret Hart wrestle on the same show, which was like Nirvana for me. And then Chris Jericho, who was like one of my favorites at that time already. So getting to see all those people on one show was a memory I'll never forget. And by the way, still the only time I've ever seen Bret Hart wrestle live. So holds a special place in my heart.
Okay, very good. Well, that brings up, I think, an interesting point, which is that Sting Hall match is kind of a dandy.
I was going to talk about a little bit
underrated.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, honestly, I think Hall as a worker, even at that time period, is a little bit underrated. I mean, let's face it, he wasn't putting on five-star classics night in and night out. He was very much a minimalist as a wrestler at that point. He could really still put it together. Like, when he showed up, he really did show up. It's just, it's like I've said in conversations we've had in the past, it wasn't often that Hall did show up in 98. In any case, Sting had a pretty truncated title run at that time period after he won the belt in controversial and then even more controversial fashion.
Some might say unique.
It was a very unique situation, exactly. What happened here? Not to fantasy book. I know that Sting had personal problems. He was plagued by some demons and by some pills, I believe. So I can see them wanting to take the belt off of him sooner rather than later. But to have him booked so weak and so poorly, it was like they put these political problems front and center. And that was really to the detriment of the product, I think. In a perfect world, what would a Sting title run circa 1998 look like to you?
Well, I mean, just speaking from a kid who was, you know, 14 at the time, or 13 going on 14, and at a middle school where everybody at that time preferred WCW to the WWF, everybody was a Sting fan. Everybody wanted to see him beat Hogan. I can say that what should have happened is he should have, and I'm normally not in favor of booking squash matches as the main event, but I think it should have been a glorified squash. I think Sting should have kicked Hogan's ass for about 5 minutes. Then everyone in the NWO should have interfered. And then the next 5 to 6 minutes should have been Sting fending off NWO interference before finally forcing Hogan to tap to the Scorpion cleanly in the middle of the ring. Then I think Sting should have had at least a 6-month title reign where he is booked as a superhero character, because that's what they had booked him for a year and a half as a vigilante superhero, Batman basically. And they needed
to book
the Crow, yeah. They needed to book him like the Crow or like Batman, where he was a guy who the bad guys were going to get their asses kicked when he showed up. And, you know, it's not like it's never been done. I mean, WWF booked Austin pretty much the way that WCW should have booked Sting, where Austin pretty much kicked the hell out of whoever he fought, even if the guy he fought was way bigger than him, like The Undertaker. I mean, I vividly remember a Raw where The Undertaker is begging off from Austin, you know, like
yeah.
That's how strong they booked him. So WCW really should have been ahead of that, and they should have been booking Sting as an intimidator and a presence that was, you know, there to defend WCW against its oppressors. And then you can build an angle where, you know, Goldberg got hot in the summer. You could have easily done an angle where Sting gets screwed out of the title, goes and tries to get revenge. Goldberg, meanwhile, rises to the forefront, wins the belt, and then you culminated at Starrcade with Goldberg versus Sting in the main event of Starrcade 98. That would have been kind of cool, in my opinion.
Yeah. I don't even have an issue with Hogan and Sting having a competitive match at Starrcade. And like you said, loads of interference, do a really overbooked kind of shit show sort of deal, but have Sting look really strong, come out on top, no bullshit, and hell, even do a rematch with Hogan, fine. He beats him again, so what? And then just feed him guys, you know, from the NWO, that, like that Hall match, prime example of the types of matches they seems like they should have been doing at the time. Savage would have been another great opponent. He just should have gone over him, not dropped the belt.
Right. You know,
3-4 months in, whatever it was. Nash, even like Henning, he still had, you know, some gas in the tank at that time.
I think a Raven and Sting feud in 1998 would have been really cool, with Sting's vigilante gimmick and Raven's loner gothic gimmick thing, you know. That would have that could have been cool, but that would have required WCW actually elevating someone that wasn't in the NWO, so as a heel.
Everyone was so siloed in WCW. Guys could still get pushes, but it would be within their little, you know, their side of the their side of the pond, so to speak. So Raven could still be a strong character in his own right, but he ain't ever touching the main event scene.
So. Well, and you mentioned real quick on Raven. It's surprising when you go back and you look at how little was done with Raven when he was at his hottest. But the other thing I was going to say is, speaking of Raven, you mentioned earlier that Sting had demons. He had pill problems at the time. It was WCW. Who didn't?
Yeah.
I mean, Kevin Nash brags about how many pills they were taking back then. Hall was wasted out of his mind. Raven was wasted. Pretty much everyone in the company except, it seemed like, DDP. Everybody else was pretty much, you know, I don't know, sleeping with someone's wife or popping steroids or consuming so much alcohol that they were developing the unfortunate beer/steroid gut. So,
yes, you know, not a good combination. And that is funny you mentioned that. It seems like they kind of held Sting to a different standard, or a double standard, really. You can make the case that perhaps he should have been more of a locker room leader and led by example, but you're right. He's not really guilty of anything that anyone else wasn't doing. So I don't get why he shows up at Starrcade untanned and out of shape, despite what certain listeners may feel about that statement. It was unfortunately true. But even that being the case, it's like, have Bischoff pull him aside, say, gosh, you need to kind of step your game up. You own a gym, for fuck's sake, hit the weights. And that could have been the end of it. You know, you still put him over strong. You don't let those kind of issues bleed over into the televised product. All it would have taken is, you know, step it up, get it together, and we're going to put the belt on you because that's the story. That's the right thing to do. That's what makes sense. But now that you're back, really be back. And I don't know if that conversation ever took place. I don't know that it would have made a difference if it had taken place, but there are some issues that I think could have been addressed before you go into the biggest world title match you've ever promoted with the return of a guy who's been on a 14-month layoff.
Right. And I mean, this is all under the assumption that the champion at the time would have allowed any of this to
sure.
happen.
Sure. Yeah.
There was some maneuvering going on at the time, I believe, from certain individuals who will remain unnamed at this time.
Jim Ross. I think he's done some other things. Not really familiar with.
And let me talk to you about Casper mattresses, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, shit.
We're talking about Sting winning the title and having this championship reign for the early part of 98. I was thinking about that. I was trying to think of how many times he's had the belt. And then I looked it up, and it's like, I don't think that he ever had a good title reign at all. So,
no.
Yeah, because usually he'd lose it like at house shows, and they wouldn't even promote like a big match. Like, he won it from Ric Flair, and then he like lost it. And it wasn't even like a show, yeah. Right? It was a house show.
Yeah, I think at the Meadowlands, yeah, in a house show.
And that was just sort of a different way that they did business back then, where the house show circuit was kind of a bigger deal. But you feel like your bigger title changes, you still want to televise.
Well, then there was the forgotten title reign where he beat Vader on a tour of Europe or something and then lost the title back to him like a week later on the same tour. It's kind of like the forgotten world title reign in Sting's career, but that was, again, all of that was untelevised. And that was in 93 when WCW really should have known better. And it's one of the many reasons why 93 is not a favorite year of mine in Turnerville. But he had the international WCW international world heavyweight title. That sadly might have been his best title. Well, might have been his best title reign, unfortunately. Then there was also the weird habit that Bill Watts had of having his champions have non-title matches on pay-per-view. Like, Sting and Cactus Jack had this awesome match at Beach Blast 92 when Sting was the champion, and it was non-title because, you know, that's a thing that you do.
That's right, yeah. That's unfortunate. You'd mentioned getting a Many Faces of Sting shirt in 1992, was it?
I think it was 92, yeah, maybe 93.
Did Sting have that many faces by 1992?
Well, it was the different kinds of face paint designs that he would have. So, like, you had, like, the American flag one from Great American Bash. You had the black and white kind of, like, OG Sting from the late 80s. You had the, you know, various different color combinations, basically. And the shirt was a hideous shirt. It was, like, Sting's face in, like three rows and three columns with different types of face paint on. And it said the Many Faces of Sting on it. But, yeah, but you know, it was cool to me because I always loved how he would, like, vary up his face paint in ways that I kind of felt like the Road Warriors and the Ultimate Warrior didn't all the time.
I think he's a guy who does his own face paint.
I saw that on one of the, it's like WWE videos, like the Best of Sting that they released. There's, like, the documentary thing, and it shows him, like, putting his face on there.
Wasn't he doing it, like, in a bathroom stall, and he just had the paint, like, kind of... It looked like he was sitting on top of either the toilet paper dispenser or a hand dryer, which I hope that was like on something and not just directly spread out on.
Yeah, that's
the disgusting
flirting with
surface.
That's flirting with hygienic disaster at a wrestling
it
show.
Really is, yeah. So that kind of took me aback when I saw it. I was like, "Ooh, that yikes!" But anyway. Welcome to Survey Says.
There was another thing I wanted to hit on. You guys mentioned Uncensored 98, the Scott Hall and Sting match, because when I was coming up with different kind of feuds that Sting had, like I watched some Vader matches, I watched Muda, and I was like, I want to watch something that's out of the ordinary, and I picked that one. And I really liked that match. I really also liked Dusty Rhodes, how he kind of snuck in and had a run-in in that match. You guys remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, right after
he was the manager of Scott Hall at the time, right?
Yeah, he kind of creeped in, did this real slow creep in, and then did like an elbow drop behind the referee's back.
And he had this, at the time, he would have these awesome, like, Dusty, I guess they were like heel smirks, but you couldn't be that mad at him because it was Dusty, because it was always like mischievous, you know? Like, he'd look at us in the crowd, and he'd just kind of like tilt his head and have this smirk on his face. But it was Dusty, so all I could do was laugh, you know?
I just wonder if Dusty and Tony's kids still played together after Dusty turned and sold out. That was such a tragic moment. I mean,
it really was.
It was like Tony was never the same after that.
Well, Tony had been going through a period of just getting a lot of disappointing things happening to him, going all the way back to Bash of the Beach 96 when he, you know, he in a moment of weakness, he damned Hulk Hogan to hell.
Really so did. That strong was words. I was, you know, quite offended, actually. But all right, what else have we got? Do you have a favorite Sting look? We're talking to many faces of Sting, like all the different variations that Surfer Sting would come out in, face paint and attire wise. Of course, got the kind of hybrid. We're not full on Crow Sting yet, but we're drifting away from Surfer Sting, where he had the dark hair and kind of the darker face paint, but he wasn't anywhere near Crow Sting levels of gothic darkness. But that was sort of an interesting period, like in 96, I feel like.
Yeah, yeah.
You, of course, do have the Crow Sting period. Is there a favorite of yours, Greg?
Yeah, you know, I like the Crow. The Crow look was awesome, especially at the time. Like, it was so – people forget how different it was from everything else in wrestling at that time. It was very cool, and everybody, you know, my age loved it at school and stuff. And I liked when he came back in 99, I thought he had a really cool, like, streamlined look where it was like he was in better shape, but it was also he was not wearing, like, the weird, you know, just the kind of weird shirt, chest piece Roman mm-hmm. Reigns thing that he was wearing for a while. Yeah. But my favorite look of Sting would have to be, like, the early 90s Sting, like, starting around Great American Bash 90. And going through about 1994 or 5, I love, like, all of those Stings. Like, probably my favorite all time was the Great American Bash with the American flag face paint and the jacket and all that stuff. But I was such – I still am to this day. I just think that Sergeant Pepper jacket look was awesome.
Yeah.
The mm-hmm. The bright multicolors. I don't really like his late 80s look, like when the basic face paint, the black and white face paint with like the really basic tights. I liked it when he had the more intricately designed tights, the really intricate face paint, and the Sergeant Pepper jacket. So that's probably my favorite era of Sting in general, and the look, because again, he just looked like a superhero. He looked like someone you'd read in a comic book, which is kind of what drew me to him in the first place.
And that stylized scorpion running down the pant leg is always it's always a highlight. Yeah, something about that when he came back in 99.
Oh man,
Andy, what was up with those boots?
Well, you can tell it better, because at first when I saw it on TV, I thought his boots were supposed to be white like that, but you said it was something else.
So. Allegedly, Sting's boots were falling apart, literally just falling apart, and he would just tape them up as a stopgap measure. Why he used what appeared to be white masking tape, I'm not too sure, but that was sort of bizarre for it going on as long as it did. He eventually did get a new pair of boots, I guess, but for a brief period there, like when he won the title from DDP on Nitro shortly after Spring Stampede, that I don't know if that was the first time I saw that, but it was right around that time where the boots were falling apart and he had that just goofy. It was almost like his boots were in a cast.
Dude, I learned something, because I've always thought those were just white boots he was wearing.
Yeah,
no, apparently they were taped up. I mean, I could be wrong, but that's the story I heard. Was somebody asked him about it, and he said, "Yeah, they're taped." Maybe he was ribbing them. I don't know.
Oh man, that's crazy, man. That's just like that's like a classic wrestler being a cheapskate story. Like,
it really is. And of course, you got the NWO red and black lobster Sting, as you referred to him earlier. That was some garbage shit. I hated that look. I hated that character. I hated everything about that.
The storyline made no sense.
No, it didn't. I just, okay, so they're supposed to be the good version of the NWO. It's still Kevin Nash. It's still Scott Hall at the time. It's Kurt Hennig and Rick Rude. What the hell? Rick Rude.
They had still spent the last year and a half beating Sting down at every opportunity they had and trying to ruin his reputation. Literally, they were just as responsible as Hogan was for the fake Sting fiasco. Like,
seriously,
why would he have ever... Like, I was okay with Lex Luger joining them before I was okay with Sting joining them.
Yeah, like, I mean, I didn't even like that, but Lex didn't really have as defined a character as Sting did.
No, Sting's character was, I hate the NWO. They are my arch nemesis. I am here to destroy the NWO. And instead he decides, you know what, it would be cool to start making noises again and hanging out with my old buddies.
And I mean, I think people forget that although Hall would split off from the group and he went heel on Nash, which didn't make a whole lot of sense, but whatever. But Kurt Hennig and Rick Rude were right there at the time too. They didn't last long with the Wolfpack either. But it was just like, this, no, why? They're not good guys just because they're wearing different colored t-shirts now. But that's how they were booked. And what was the end game of the Wolfpack anyway? What were they trying to do? They hated Hogan. Okay, fine. So they break off and they're the splinter group, but they're too small and don't really have enough pull because Bischoff's not there pulling the strings anymore. So what are they trying to accomplish even? What was even the point? It was just...
The point was to make as many then contemporary hip-hop references as possible in promo segments. So the point was to show the world that they indeed were bowdy-bowdy and rowdy-rowdy.
Well, yeah, to give Conan a rap career, huh?
Well, on that Sting video, the WWE release one, it had matches kind of interspersed with Sting talking and other people talking about him. And on that video, he does talk about the black and red Wolfpack. And Greg actually said, hey, now I get to hang out with my buddies and make noise. And that's pretty much what he said. He said he liked doing that because as the black and white, he didn't really talk and he didn't get to interact with the fans. And this way, he said he got to kind of, be the happy Sting again.
And I get that. And I think there's actually a valid point there because Sting as the Vigilante was always like...
The what?
I'm sorry, as I don't mean to use WWE branding. Sting as the Crow was always kind of trying to force him into a role that hid his natural talents. Sting's greatest talents as a wrestler were his just in-ring charisma, his weird energy that he had, and his selling also. And his character, A, didn't need to be selling that much, and B, couldn't go around and pound his chest and slap hands with the fans. And Sting just always had a connection with people. And so I get that, but the NWO Wolfpack was not the way to do it. Like, when he came back in 99, that was the way to do it. Like, the It's Showtime Sting and all that, because he still had the cool look of the updated look of the Crow and all that. But he was able to go out and slap hands with the fans again and, like, do the woo, the woo that I liked, the good guy woo. And, it was just a better time for him at that time. I don't think the answer was like looking like a lobster and, hanging out with Conan.
Right. It's funny now that I think about it, on paper, the very concept of Crow Sting, where we're going to turn this guy into this brooding, silent loner, sounds like the worst possible thing you can do to Steve Borden. Because like you said, it really takes away all of his natural assets and that charisma, that connection with the fans. But it just worked so well.
It worked. And yeah, it really did.
It's funny. The case can be made that where do you go from there after he has gotten a big win? So he wins the title. he's gained a measure of redemption. He's sort of maybe rediscovering his faith in humanity. Was sort of a direction it seemed like they were hinting at the time. But it was like all of a sudden he's palling around with Luger again. He's doing, you know, kind of main event tag matches again. But it was like he never had the big reconciliation that I think they needed to in order to connect those dots. Because so much of that was, you know, he broke from tradition. He broke from the allies that he had been associated with up to that point in his career in late 96 and took to the rafters and didn't trust anybody. And all of a sudden it was like, okay, I won the title. Everything's cool now. But they're still trying to hang on to that drop from the rafters, dark charisma. And like he said, it maybe had worn out its welcome by then. And it was time to not go back to Surfer Sting, of course. That would have been way too regressive. But
right.
99 is where they found the sweet spot, I would agree.
Yeah, I think the whole Sting character was predicated on the NWO having an ending.
In other words, really.
The character works to the point that he destroys the NWO. Now, you could stretch it out past Starrcade by having Hall and Nash say, all right, well, Hogan couldn't get the job done. Forget him. We're going to do it now. And then Sting gradually goes through them, and the NWO splinters apart, and that's the end of the NWO. That was the natural ending of that group, was Sting destroys the NWO. And then at that point, you can have his character be like, I've spent the last 2 years obsessed with destroying this group, and now they're destroyed. Now what? And moving on from there and evolving as a character. But unfortunately, we never got that satisfaction because the NWO just did not die. It just drug on and on and on and on.
Indeed. Well, Andy, do you have a favorite version of Sting?
Well, I had a thought earlier, and it popped out of my head, and then it came back. But it's that I do like the shorter-haired version of Sting, because I think the longer his hair got, the more he sucked.
Samson in reverse, huh?
Yeah.
On that note,
I really liked Rat. I really liked Rat Tail Sting. That's kind of where he kind of had some long hair, but not enough to suck.
True. Yeah, he could get away. He could get away with it then, right? The Rat Tail.
Who did as long as long tail? As he could have long hair, as long as it was only in one spot.
Yes. But who didn't have a rat tail in the late 80s, early 90s? I'll confess to that. And there are probably pictures. Hopefully they aren't in anyone else's possession. But if they are, then I...
It'll come back in style before too long, Tim.
This is true. Yeah, this is true. I think I'll be okay. Well, we should probably be coming up on a break at this point. What do you think, gentlemen? Is this a good time to throw it to our sponsors and reconvene?
Yeah, I see no reason why not. Let Lord Alfred pay some bills.
Don't touch that dial, fans. We'll be back with more Sting memories, Sting matches, Sting moments on Survey Says.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you're subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Just head to iTunes today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be podcast feed, the PWO PTBN feed, PTBN Pop, and of course the Kevin Kelly Show feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Some really great stuff. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. Thanks for being a fan of professional wrestling. More importantly, thanks for being a fan and supporter of the Place to Be Nation.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here. In addition to the archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, Main Event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's Past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. All of this in addition to Scott Keith's Podcast of Doom, which includes discussions on questions from listeners as well as current day and old school wrestling. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClun Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows are available on PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the reaction shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
We're back on Survey Says from the rafters at the United Center in Chicago, Illinois. It is Andy Savage along with Tim and Greg, and we're still talking about the man they call Sting. To continue our discussion of Sting and his greatest feuds, what about the time he teamed up with the Giant and they were wacky tag team partners?
Yeah, in 98, they were the tag team champions, and then Giant went NWO Hollywood, defended the belts against the Outsiders at Slamboree, right, in 98. Mm-hmm. I believe had the Giant already, he hadn't turned at that point, but that's when Scott Hall turned on Nash in that match.
No, the Giant actually was a heel because he had went Hollywood, I think, the week before.
So he had already turned going into that match.
Why did they team up in the first place? That's I can't remember.
Well, they were already, when both of them were faces, that's when they won the belts, I believe.
No, they won them.
They won them in that match, didn't they?
Yeah.
They kind of teamed when they were both faces, you know, before the whole NWO split. Then it is bizarre the way they booked that match. So Giant had already turned. Hall turned on Nash in the match. So Sting and Giant won. They had the belts. And that's right, because Giant told Sting he had to make a choice. Whether he was staying WCW or he was coming with him over to NWO Hollywood. And Sting responded by, you remember the reveal where he shows that he has the NWO black and white shirt on, and it's like, oh no, Sting's going heel. He takes the shirt off in dramatic fashion to reveal the red and black, and then body slams the Giant.
And I think the idea was, and it probably worked for the live audience, the idea was, cool, he's with the good NWO. But my reaction when I was watching it was, this doesn't make any damn sense. They're ruining Sting.
Yeah, that was kind of mine, too. Even being as lukewarm on Sting as I was like, for his character, this is stupid. And I thought the whole Wolfpack thing was stupid, frankly. But we've already covered that. And then, so at Great American Bash, that's where they have the singles match for control of the tag team titles, right? Again.
See, cigarette smoking giant, right? Versus.
Oh my God, yeah.
That's why I wanted to bring that up, because I remember that our buddy Brock, I think he used that as his avatar on LiveJournal, the cigarette smoking giant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The old Cruise World Order, the late Cruise World Order. Yeah. That was some excellent character work for the giant. I wonder how much of that was legit and how much was just, you know, played up for the camera.
According to the Big Show, he says that who for those who don't know, the Big Show is the giant.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, I know. I was shocked to find out too.
When you said Big Show, I'm thinking, which big was that? A WCW pay-per-view? What's a Big Show?
Yeah, well, apparently it's a modern day professional wrestler, and he did what is known as a shoot interview, and in it he said that he was actually, in typical WCW fashion, he was actually smoking a cigarette backstage, and Eric Bischoff told him, "Hey, you're supposed to be going out for a match." And he said, "Really?" And Bischoff said, "Yes." And so he started walking to the ring and forgot he had the cigarette in his mouth.
Oh my God.
And then they just decided to make it part of his deal.
That's how he became the smoking giant.
Yep.
And that's also when he really started putting on weight.
Yeah.
Which I'm not like trying to fat shame him or whatever. No, it's just the Big Show certainly has that reputation for slimming down, and as soon as he gets back on the road, it's just hell for him. He starts packing on the pounds again, and eventually just, it's like a cyclical thing, it seems like, where he has to just slow down, get off the road, get healthy, but as soon as he goes back to that lifestyle, you know, it's just a matter of time, unfortunately. Because he'd been in good shape.
And oh, yeah.
As I described, I think, on our pilot, downright svelte at the time.
Yeah.
He was a regular Zack Sabre Jr.
I don't emaciated, in fact. He was doing missile drop kicks and whatnot. He you know, and in 1996, in fact, he was in such phenomenal shape that I would argue that he had one of the better rookie years in WCW history.
No doubt.
He was very, very impressive in 96. And Andy, you actually recently reviewed, or viewed maybe for the first time, the Great American Bash 1996 championship match between Sting and the Giant, when the Giant was the rookie unstoppable world champion. Sting was in the dark hair but still surfer Sting phase. What did you make of that match?
I think I'd watched that way back years ago. I guess I couldn't remember if it was good or not. So, yeah, I watched that match, and I'd say it was really good. He was really fired up against the Giant.
It kind of leads into something that I have always thought about Sting, is that he is one of the best. First of all, he's one of the best baby faces to me of all time in terms of just understanding timing and stuff like that. But he was at his best working against big guys for whatever reason. And Sting was a pretty big guy, about 6'3", 6'4", about 250. But he worked so well against big guys. And with the Giant, I thought that Sting, more so than most of the other guys on the roster, maybe other than Flair, understood how to accentuate the Giant's strengths and make him look like a killer, like a beast. But Sting himself could give it back. Like you said, Andy, he was so fired up as a babyface. He had the best babyface fire to this day of anybody I've ever seen, in terms of the ability to fire up out of the corner and make his comeback, or to me, when Sting executed the slam on the Giant, it was such a cool moment. They built the story for so long in the match, And it was just really, it was just wrestling psychology 101. And not
he
like,
made it look easy too when he
yep.
slammed someone of that size. People don't, I think, realize what a strong motherfucker Sting is. Where, you know, one of the centerpieces to a lot of his matches, not guys the size of Giant, but still big dudes like Barry Windham, big, would be, you know, the full on body press. Mm-hmm. And it is extremely difficult to press a human being over your head, no matter what they weigh. And he would do that with ease to lots of guys who are his size or even bigger. And that just it's a spot that stands out to me as always being really impressive. But I mean, for Sting to just be able to do that on a consistent basis and still bump like he does, and move as well as he does, is really a credit to him.
Yeah, and I always loved, he did one of my favorite stagger cells of any wrestler. In other words, that cell that he would do where he would take maybe it was a punch to the face, maybe it was an elbow, maybe it was a big boot, and he would like fly across the ring but stay on his feet, but kind of like maybe stagger to one knee and then wobble back to his feet and kind of come back. Like, he really sold very, very well and understood when it was time to fire up and be the Superman. But he sold to a degree that made his opponents look great and that built an easily digestible story for his matches. Like, I think one of the reasons kids always loved Sting, looking back on it, myself included, is it was very easy to follow the story of his matches because he was so good at the basic stuff, like knowing exactly when to do what it was he was going to do. And part of that was having great opponents, true. But part of that was also just a natural, instinctual babyface charisma that I think is really rare in wrestling. And in that Giant match that Andy was mentioning, I think that was a really good example of that. And I think that at that time in WCW, Sting was kind of, I don't want to say he was getting lost in the shuffle necessarily, but he was not getting pushed to the moon certainly anymore. And it was just a great reminder that this dude was capable of going out there and tearing the house down in the right circumstances.
Yeah, because there are two points that I wanted to make about these Giant matches. And they kind of shared some spots in both the 96 and 98 matches. But you're talking about how he sold. The spot was really cool. They started off the match, I think, the same way in both those matches. They kind of crisscrossed, ran back and forth, and then Sting went for like a crossbody, and boom, he like smacked into him and went flying off like Giant. He held his ground. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that pinball selling that Henning, and you think of guys like Shawn Michaels doing, not quite to that extent, but you're right that Sting could really bump and sell his ass off. And was that style was really complimented by a dude like the Giant. And I do think that 96 match at, again, Great American Bash is the better of the two that we've mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 98 had some, I think, storyline issues going on that took away from the match itself. But yeah, two guys that just they just really gelled and didn't work together too often. So those could be overlooked potentially by folks who think of good Sting matches, don't necessarily have the Giant notched in there.
The thing I wanted to say with the Sting and Giant thing is, like, I had hung out with Kurt, you know, Kurt Kilberg, one of our buddies. I had remembered something that's on a Nitro back in like 96 when Ric Flair had like the table at ringside. I couldn't remember if somebody got chokeslammed through that table. So we were trying to pull up different Nitros from 96. And there was a match we came across where it was Sting and Luger against Flair and the Giant. And there was a really hilarious spot where I think the Giant, he's got Luger around the throat and Sting's like trying like hell to break the hold. And he's like running up, kicking the Giant, goes off the top rope, hits him with the axe handle, and Giant is still holding strong on Luger. And they're like trying everything. And they actually did that in the Slamboree match too. They redid the same thing. I forget how they end up breaking the hold on the Giant, but it was just still funny how, like, Sting's, like, you know, giving it all he's got, like, you know, with, like, elbows and punches, and Giant's just holding on to him.
Yeah, I remember that. I actually remember that because at the time I thought, man, the Giant is so freaking strong. They can't break his grip for anything. I was like, I was totally buying into it, hook, line, and sinker.
Excellent. Yeah, I haven't, I don't think I've seen that. You said that was in 96?
Yeah, it was on a Nitro.
On a Nitro?
Yeah, in the tag match, but then they did it in that title match, too, with Sting and the Giant.
I will have to track that down. That was not on my watch list.
What? We've been talking about this match the whole time, and you haven't even watched it?
I watched the two singles matches he had with Giant, but I didn't see that tag match with Luger. And Giant and Flair were quite the combo.
The classic hilarious spot with where Giant won the title, where Flair had him in the figure four, and he was so happy, and then Giant sat up, and Flair did the oh no face, and then Giant yes. just grabbed his throat from the figure four and chokeslammed him. That was awesome.
He's just shaking his head. No, no,
no, no. Oh God.
Oh shit. So we ready to talk some Sting Vader at this point? I've been itching to get into these matches and this feud.
The man called Sting versus the man they call Vader.
Oh my God. All right, so straight up, I'll ask both you guys this question. Greg, which is your favorite of the Sting Vader matches, if there's one that is just head and shoulders ahead of the pack for you? Does one stand out more than others? Because they're all just tremendous in their own way.
Yeah, every one of them. Okay, I will give you the one that I remember the most, the one that I always think back to the most, which is just speaks to as you. It's weird because I always look at it as like the death of Superman in wrestling, which was Great American Bash 92. Like I'm a sucker for the monster heel coming in and like shockingly beating the hero. And so Great American Bash 92, which actually made me cry when I watched it the first time.
Oh my God.
Legitimately. Wow. I was 8 years old. I felt so bad for Sting. I was like, you know, my dad had told me that wrestling was they were not really hurting each other and everything, but I watched that match and I was like, and honestly, what I know now about Vader is probably true. I was like, he really looks like he's hurting Sting, and right. Sting lost the title, and I was so disappointed, and I cried, and so I always think back to that one. But their best match, in my opinion, King of Cable Finals for sure, Starrcade '92. I think that match is I wouldn't change a thing about it. I think it's perfect.
Starrcade '92, my favorite pay per view. Far from it, actually.
The show sucked. Yeah, that match was. I love that match. Like I think that was the first time he did the German suplex on Vader, which at the time when I watched the VHS tape when I was a kid, I was like jumping out of my seat at that. I was like just flabbergasted. I had no idea that Scott Steiner had done a German suplex to Vader in Japan on multiple occasions. To me, that was like a first. So,
right. Andy, do you have a favorite?
The one that's my favorite, I could probably talk about it all night long, and I'll try to keep it kind of short, but I'm going to throw another shout-out to Kurt Kilberg because he kind of rescued me in 2006 because that was when I had an all-time low in WWE. I really wasn't paying attention anymore, and so I started tape trading with him, and I got a whole bunch of early 90s WCW that I had not seen before. So it was almost like a whole new world, and... So the match that is my favorite Sting-Vader match, it's probably my favorite WCW match ever and maybe in my top five all time. It is Sting versus Vader, the White Castle of Fear. I just love the heck out of that match, and it is really is like I tried to come up with a way to describe it like at work today. Like I didn't want to just say that I love this match. Here's the way that I came up to describe it. It's like – they have chicken soup for the soul. Well, I've got White Castle for the soul.
I love it.
There's just something about that match where all their matches are almost the same. They're just like brutal, where they're just like beating the heck out of each other. But with this one, they have that strap, and Vader, he like is whipping Sting around. Like, he just whips the strap, and Sting goes flying. So it's another thing where he's selling for those big guys, where he's just bouncing around like a pinball with Vader just swinging the strap around. I think they're both like bloody in that match, and Vader's like masks off, and I don't know. It's crazy.
Have you ever heard Sting talk about that rivalry much?
I've heard Vader talk about it. I think I've heard Sting talk about it a little bit, but I'm glad you brought that up, because I'm reminded of something that Vader actually said about their feud and that match in particular. But go ahead with what you're going to say about Sting.
Yeah.
The first time I ever remember Sting talking about that rivalry with Vader was on a WCW VHS release in 99 that was called like Sting Unmasked or something, which was strange because he never wore a mask, but they called it that anyway. And anyway, it was kind of like him without his face paint on, just kind of talking like candidly about his career. And it was kind of like semi-kayfabe, kind of not, but he was talking about the Vader rivalry, and the guy, whoever was doing the interview, asked him about Vader. And, you know, Sting's the nicest guy in wrestling, notoriously, and all that. And so he was like, oh, you know, he's a great guy. He's a great opponent and all that. But he's like, I got to be honest. When he first came in, he was a little wild. He was a little reckless. I had to tame him a little bit. But once I gave it back to him, you know, we had a mutual respect for each other. And in recent years, he's talked in some interviews about how basically Vader beat the shit out of him the very first time they wrestled. And Sting was like, okay, like, you know, don't do that again. And then Vader was like, doing it again. And so Sting just started beating him back, and they gained like a mutual respect for each other that like, okay, this is how our matches are going to be. We're just going to legitimately strike one another about the head and neck area for as long as we can.
That's exactly what Vader said pretty much on. He did one of the, he and Sting both were on one of those, what is it, Table for Three on the network?
Table for Three, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, and they were talking about some of their matches, and Vader's so funny, because when you see him in interviews where he's not playing the character and he's not, you know, kayfabing it, he's a very soft-spoken guy to the point that you kind of have to lean in to even hear him. And just a really, seems like a mild-mannered person in his personal life, which I guess he saved that for his matches where he would just really turn it on in the ring. But he talked about the strap match, and he was like, you know, Sting, you beat me mercilessly. It hurt. I mean, it really hurt. And Sting's response was basically, dude. I mean, he just sort of looked at him like, kidding. And I mean, supposedly from Vader's perspective, he's explained it as that's just kind of the only way he knows how to work, was I don't know how to make it look like I'm hurting someone without really actually punching them in the face, so I'm just going to full on punch him in the face.
Bret Hart just had an aneurysm.
I know, right? I mean, it's kind of not the mark of a great wrestler, but hey, produce some
classics, didn't it?
Super entertaining matches, yeah. And I don't know, if I had to pick a favorite, I would probably go White Castle of Fear too. I mean, just for as different as it was from their other matches, and as just hard hitting and brutal as it is, I think I go there. But Greg, you mentioning that Great American Bash match in the context of a Death of Superman doomsday-esque performance by Vader makes me want to revisit that now.
That's so, how I viewed it. That's how, because I think, you know, I heard about Sting's loss, which is actually, when I think back to it, what made me cry was actually the WCW Saturday Night when they showed footage of the, or it might have been the main event or something, where they showed footage of the match and showed that Sting had lost to Vader and basically clean. And I was like, that's what bummed me out. But when I actually watched the VHS, was around the same time that Death of Superman was happening in the comics. And so I've always associated it with that, because like, here's this big monster heel who comes in and basically bludgeons my hero to death, essentially. And the death of Sting's push as well, because Sting was shunted down into weird feuds with Jake the Snake the rest of the year. So
true. Well, that is a first. It's, I mean, we've got actual tears recalled here on the podcast. So this could be an answer to two questions, actually. What is your favorite Vader Sting match? Even though you said it wasn't necessarily your favorite, but you had to mention it. And I think it is the favorite of a lot of people's. And the question as well, has anything in wrestling ever made you cry? And I don't know that anything has for me, but Greg Phillips, I feel like that's a scoop. That's really something.
And you don't even have to call the hotline to get it.
I couldn't be happier right now. This is some quality programming. Andy, what were you about to say?
It's not as important as crying.
There is crying in wrestling, damn it.
There is.
Well, I was just going to say that I hadn't really watched the Fall Brawl match, where it was actually the triangle match, and they eliminated, I think it was Guardian Angel. And then Sting and Vader had their own match. And that match might almost actually be their best one, because it just goes on forever. I think that was 15 minutes. Then they had a 5-minute overtime. And then there was a sudden death thing. And they are really, just beating the hell out of each other. And even Heenan, he really puts it over on commentary. And I wrote down kind of what he said. He was like, he said something like, how do you beat this man? Do you super glue his shoulders to the mat? Do you hit him with an anvil? What do you do to him? And it just really sold Vader as a monster.
That's one that I think it's kind of lost. That whole period for Sting is sort of...
the post-Hogan period?
Exactly. Where he's sort of feuding with... He's not really feuding with Vader. He wins, like you said, the title shot, right?
Yeah, he was feuding in 94 with Avalanche and then Ming, I believe, during the summer when he first came in. Or maybe that was the next year.
I think that was 95.
Yeah. 95, yeah. So basically he spent 94 feuding with Avalanche and then later the Shark when he became the Shark. So
that was when Rude's career was winding down, so they had some matches.
Yeah, because I don't
know. Oh, yeah, and the first half of 94 was, like, Rude, and he briefly had that. He wasn't even feuding with Vader, because they just had, like, one-off matches
in 94. Right, exactly. Yeah, that's what I was saying.
And then Ric Flair for the international heavyweight unification match. And then, like, I don't remember what he did over the summer, and then they did the triangle match, and then he started feuding with Avalanche.
He had some singles matches with Boss / Guardian / Big Bubba / Ray Traylor.
Dude, that's right. I remember how it went now. They did the triangle match, and that began the Guardian Angels' gradual heel turn when he turned on Sting and became Big Bubba at the end of the year. As everybody did in WCW, if they wanted to turn heel, they turned on Sting. So Big Bubber.
Big Bubber. Back to Big Bubber.
As Dusty would call him. He turned on Sting and became Big Bubber again, and they feuded, and then Sting wrestled the Avalanche, Earthquake, if you will, for a couple months, and then it was a series of Sting feuding with people that were not considered to be main eventers, but right. You know, what can you do?
But those Big Bubber matches are kind of not bad, if I
remember. Very good, I think. I mean, Bubber was underrated in general, but certainly the Sting matches with those two, they were pretty solid, especially for 1994 WCW.
I think we've kind of charted the major feuds here, but I kind of want to get into as well are any hidden gems, just maybe one-off matches or something that you feel like hasn't been well documented over the years or maybe has gone overlooked. I know we've talked about a few here and there. I've got one in mind, actually, and I'll go ahead and throw it out there, actually. It's Sting and Nikita Koloff versus Arn and Tully. I think it's from a Super Brawl, or no.
No, it wouldn't be
Super Brawl. No, it couldn't have been. Super Brawl didn't start till 91.
Yeah.
Right, right. Doesn't matter. Point is, I think the only way that a lot of people have seen this match is on the Turner Home Entertainment home release VHS, where it is heavily clipped. It's only about 10 minutes, as I understand, on the commercial version. But the match actually goes, well, I don't want to spoil it, but it's a pretty long match. And the reason I liked it so much is there's not really an extended heat segment on either of the faces. It's a pretty evenly paced match for both teams, mostly favoring Sting and Nikita for the most part. And it moves at a good clip, really well paced, not really any dull spots. But the pops from the crowd, whenever Sting or Nikita make a big comeback, I shit you not, are some of the loudest sustained pops I have ever heard. I don't know if it's just how the arena was mic'd or what, but just for this random tag match, I mean, people are screaming. It is deafening. Like, you can't even hear the announcers. Just when Sting makes a comeback, hits a clothesline or drop kick or something. I mean, I was really taken aback. I'm like, okay, I know Sting is over. I know he got, you know, good pop from the crowd, but I've like never heard anything like this. And it was in Baltimore. I do remember that. So it's definitely not Chi-Town Rumble.
Oh, it was apparently Great American Bash 88.
So yeah, check that out on the network because you'll get the complete match. It's a good just hot tag match from early in Sting's career when he wasn't known for having a lot of great matches back then outside of Flair. But of course, you know, Arn and Tully, you're not going to go wrong with that. That would be one I can definitely put up there as a hidden gem in Sting's resume. Anything from you, gentlemen?
One that is kind of under the radar, and it's kind of tastes will vary based on how you feel about this opponent's style, but I recently revisited Great American Bash 96, Great American Bash 95, I think it was. I think that's right. Anyway, the match that I'm referring to is Sting versus Lord Steven Regal. And this is...
That was 96, yes.
Yeah, 96. This was a match between Sting and Regal, and you would not think that their styles would mesh very well. I was a fan of Regal, especially in WCW, but he needed to have the right kind of opponents to mesh with, and I didn't think Sting would be that guy for him. And so I had never watched the match until about maybe 7 or 8 months ago, and I actually watched it with Nick and my cohort Nick Duke of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We were watching
this. Associate with a man like Nick Duke, who he's a self-professed Hulkamaniac. I mean, this seems to fly in the face of everything that you are as a wrestling fan, Greg.
I'm not going to lie. It's led to some conflicts over the years.
It has.
You know, it's led to some barbs, some dissent. But on this day, we just had it on as almost as background noise. And I can't remember exactly why we were watching it, but that match, about halfway through it, we kind of realized this is pretty damn good, actually. Like, they're really stiffing each other, and they're it's a side of Sting that you really never got to see. It felt like he was in a war. Like he was just in, it almost was like if you know, I'm an MMA fan, so it's almost like when you watch a fighter who is heavily favored and much more talented than his opponent, but he kind of underestimates his opponent, and about, you know, about two rounds into the fight, he realizes that, uh-oh, I better turn it up or I could actually lose this. And that's what the story they kind of told with that match, because Regal put him through the ringer, and Sting really had to fight back in the match. And it was, I think it's a really good hidden gem, and it's one that not a lot of people, I think, have seen and not a lot of people really remember. But if you go back and watch it, it's really good, hard-hitting stuff. So that would be my selection there. And then, even though I don't really think it's a hidden gem at this point, obviously the DDP match from Nitro in 99 is a classic. So
I was hoping one of you would mention that Regal match. So that was on my list too. So I had a awesome feeling one of you might. So that's good. And the DDP match, that's a good choice as well, because they had two matches that were pretty memorable, I felt like, for Nitros. They had one in 98 when DDP was the U.S. champion. So he challenged Sting for the world title. And I feel like that match is overrated and is remembered more for the really cool finish that it has.
Right.
So,
yeah.
99 comes along. Now it's Sting going against DDP for the title, Sting the challenger. They have a much, much better match and rips off the same finish as the 98 one, which, well, I'm not going to give it away if no one's seen it, but it is a cool finish. So they did the finish twice, but the 99 match is better.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if it's a Sting match and it's 98 versus 99 is going to be better.
Yeah, that's a given. That's a good point. Andy, what have you got?
I guess my underrated one was just going to be the giant one at 96. So now I got nothing. Thanks.
Well, I actually have another one to throw in, if that's it. All right.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Speaking of 1999 Sting, and this is under the radar, again, I think I mentioned this to you guys in the chat. He wrestled Chris Benoit on a Monday Nitro. This was around the time that he had just turned heel. Right,
it was,
after,
yeah,
he
was
had,
in September of 99.
Yep. And it didn't go super long. I mean, it had a schmoz finish, if memory serves. But damn, if that wasn't an entertaining match. Like, I just remember being on the edge of my seat. Now, granted, I was a mark for both guys at the time. But I thought that it Sting, to me, in 1999 was a man rejuvenated. He was genuinely a wrestler reborn that year, but he was just programmed with a lot of shit opponents like Rick Steiner and Hulk Hogan. And but
oh
when
God,
he got,
it just reminded me of something that we're gonna have to get into. I've just added to another list.
Is it related to dogs?
It sure is.
Oh man! But when he was in there with an actual legitimate opponent, whether it be Booker T, whether it be Scott Steiner, whether it be DDP, and then he wrestled Malenko and Benoit on Nitro and just tore it down with them, man. He was fast, he was crisp, the match was great. Benoit was, you know, at the height of his skills as a wrestler at that time, and I remember them. It's, again, I don't want to get anybody's hopes up, it's not super long. But for a Nitro match in 99, it's pretty damn good. So check that out if anybody has the opportunity.
I've seen that match exactly one time, and it's when it actually aired back in 1999. And there is one spot that still stands out in my mind from that match, and it's Benoit doing like the Muda Lock, where it's that bridging STF, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so he has it on, and then he like rolls over onto his stomach and has Sting actually elevated in the hold, which was something I had never seen before. So for that alone, that match is really memorable to me. So it's one that I'm glad you reminded me of, because I do want to check it out again. But yeah, I kind of have the same memories from that.
Yeah. I haven't seen it since then either. I just remembered, like, that was a match that stood out to me from 1999, which was a year that did not have a lot of standout televised matches. So
I don't think I have any other hidden gems I want to call attention to. I mean, there are some TV matches from kind of the early and mid 90s that have been to a certain extent just lost to time.
Mm-hmm.
There was a Vader match on, I don't know what, maybe Worldwide or Power Hour.
I think it was Worldwide, yeah.
Yeah, the Bounty match.
Yeah, the Bounty match, yeah, where he broke his ribs, right?
That's worth checking out, although I don't know. It's on one of his DVDs. I'm not sure if it's on Best of Sting or Into the Light.
Into the Light.
Can't see it on the network yet because they haven't added. I don't know where Worldwide is on the list of on the priority for WCW Network. I mean, WCW Network. Can you imagine WWE Network uploads? I want a WCW Network, obviously.
Me too.
He had a there was a cactus match too. That was on one of those DVDs, I think from 91. So it was before they were really like even properly feuding, I want to say.
Yeah, this was when Cactus Jack jumped out of the birthday box. He was one of the bounty. He was one of the guys that somebody was calling in, quote unquote, hitmen to come in and attack Sting. Abdul the Butcher, Cactus Jack, a few other wrestlers, and they ended up revealing that it was Lex Luger that had been paying all these people to come in and attack Sting because Luger wanted to make sure Sting couldn't challenge him for his title.
Right. Yeah. So that was, looking at it now, Power Hour from November of 91.
As JR called it, the Power Hour.
Power. Yeah.
The P-A-R-H-A-R.
Like the Iron Man match.
That's right.
But this was a submit or surrender match. Worth checking out. I do remember seeing that. And I do recall now that you mentioned it. It was the Luger thing. That brings up another point. I don't know if this is a hot take necessarily, but for as much as Sting and Luger worked together, they didn't have a whole lot of matches against one another. Normally they were, you know, paired as a tag team, but when they did actually face each other one-on-one, I don't think they had a single good match. I watched it the other night and I just,
maybe it's just nostalgia for me.
It just didn't do it for me. I didn't hate it, but it just didn't do anything for me.
Hey, I think
Luger was definitely not giving a crap at that point.
I think I shortchanged the one where they wrestled at the Starrcade 89, because after we taped that show, and I didn't really have much to say about 89, I actually got the network app on my phone. I was watching that on a lunch break, and I was like, they both seemed kind of fired up for that one, or maybe it was just the first match on the show, and they were kind of fresh, and I thought it was kind of a good match.
I would say that show burned me out so bad that I might have shortchanged it as well, but when you mentioned it was the first match on the show, it just tells you how much all those matches just blur together in my head. But yeah, I might be selling that one short just because I don't really remember anything from it. They of course had the excellent lumberjack arm cast match in 2000 at Super Brawl.
2000.
I think it was.
I would challenge you, Tim, that actually wasn't Lex Luger versus Sting. That was Sting versus the Total Package, I believe.
You're right. I take that back, and I do apologize. He was the Total Package at that. And you want to talk about not giving a shit. Ooh. That was actually uncensored 2000. Yeah.
I wonder if that's where Vince got the idea to start taking guys' names away. If he like looked at Lex Luger in 2000, he's like, well, he lost his name and it worked. He was a Total Package.
Yeah.
Guess what?
The Big Valbowski.
You're just going to be Cesaro, for God's sake. I like the name Big E Langston, but I like the name Big E a little bit more.
quite frankly, is how Vince's mind works. On the subject of hot takes, a guy we haven't really mentioned up to this point, Muta. I don't dislike any of their matches. It just, all of them feel really short to me. They feel like half of a really good match. And they kind of end a little bit abruptly for one reason or another. I know they did the whole thing where the TV title was held up because both guys were pinned, or maybe just Sting was pinned, and they had to do the rematch, which ended in kind of a fuck finish. So, I mean, there was that element to it, but it just, for whatever reason, they didn't give them a lot of time. And I don't understand why, because they had good chemistry and both guys could still go the distance. This is when Muta still had knees and could move around pretty well. And he was like,
God damn you, bringing up knees.
Hey, it's not the first time for this show. Bret Hart and his knees, they're too low to the ground.
Give it to me straight, Doc.
Terry, you have no knees.
What are you saying?
You shouldn't be wrestling, Terry.
Put it to me in English, Doc.
For God's sake. Muta was like kind of the anti-Sting. Does that make sense?
I was going to say I thought they were kind of evenly matched. They seemed like Sting's almost like wrestling himself. I don't know. That makes
sense. Yeah, I mean, I think we're kind of saying the same thing. We're just character-wise, he's
the reverse Sting.
The reverse Sting. That's what I should have said. Yes. But, Greg, I think you're a little bit higher on their series than I am. But I mean, like I said, I don't hate it. I don't dislike any of those matches. I'm just like, why didn't they give these guys any time?
Again, nostalgia for me, because the Great Muta was mind-blowing in 1989. Like, when I was 5 years old, I had never seen anybody do the things that the Great Muta was doing. And then I saw Sting match him. I'll never forget watching Great American Bash 89 the first time, which is still their best match, probably. But when Sting did the dive from one ring into the other, I legitimately thought that life couldn't get any better than that. I was like, I will never see anything cooler than that. Like, it really was an impressive feat of athleticism. And I was like, you know, that match was awesome, I thought. And then I loved their TV series, which I have really hard time finding online, but they had a TV series.
I do too. I was looking for it the other day.
If the WWE Network would get off their ass and upload all of the WCW television that I want to see, then I would be able to find it all. But I really, really loved their series over the TV title. And then, you know, whenever they would team or wrestle each other, I always was looking forward to it, because I always had kind of an attachment to Muta. And as a young kid, I didn't realize how, like, lazy Muta got in his U.S. appearances later on. But, you know, I remember that one cool match they did was Sting and Muta versus the Steiner Brothers for one of those New Japan crossover shows.
Yeah, that was from the second WCW super show that they did with New Japan, right?
Yeah. And I don't remember much about the match, because I haven't seen it in so many years, but I remember when I was a kid loving it, because I loved all four guys, and seeing Sting and Muta team up was like, you know, seeing Batman and Superman team up or something like that. It was like, wow, the two coolest wrestlers from a couple years ago are now on the same side, and they're going up against these two guys who, you know, seem like they can suplex a mountain, you know. So that, I don't know if the match is any good. I don't know if you've watched it recently, Tim, but I don't remember if the match is good or not. But,
and I've been wanting to watch it, because I feel like I've heard good things about it. And I mean, it's Sting, Muta, Steiners in 92. It seems like it'd be pretty hard to go wrong. We've kind of gone through some highlights. Had a few hot takes. Now I think we need to delve into some lowlights. In the spirit of keeping things on a positive note, I think we all have a pretty good sense of humor, but boy, did Sting get plugged into some nonsense, some real nonsense over the course of his career.
Some creatively questionable decisions, ladies and gentlemen.
Some unique situations.
In the industry, yes.
And I think the best way to approach that is probably to hit them chronologically. So that takes us back to 1990. We've got Capital Combat. Sting was injured at the time, was he not?
Yep.
He had destroyed his knee, essentially. He was on the shelf. Did not stop him from making an appearance at this great WCW pay-per-view. He had a somewhat unique ally at this show, did he not? Who was who came to Sting's defense when he was looking to go down for the dirt nap?
In a great bit of synergy with my life, it was the the lead character from the very first movie I ever saw at a movie theater. It was the half man, half machine, all cop, RoboCop.
I'd buy that for a dollar.
It's brilliant. That's brilliant. So yeah, a bit of cross promotion with the RoboCop sequel.
We've come into some controversy because we're still trying to figure this out, but there is word that apparently that we were talking about earlier in the day that apparently it was actually Peter Weller playing RoboCop at Capital Combat 90.
Right. So, like you said, there's some disagreement over this, but Jim Cornette, who was there, on the record as stating that this was actually Peter Weller as RoboCop, which, when you think about it, it does kind of make sense because this is going to sound like such an absurd statement, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. RoboCop was not an easy part for someone to play. And if you've watched any of like the behind the scenes stuff on like the RoboCop DVD, which there have been several releases over the years, but Peter Weller talks about, you know, just getting into character and what he had to do in order to actually perform under that amount of prosthesis. And I want to say he talks about actually taking professional miming classes because it was so difficult to move and to emote and to just do anything in that suit. So you can't just throw any random guy out there to do that. I mean, I guess you could, but I think it would have been really obvious and really even more embarrassing than it actually was. If the person portraying RoboCop didn't actually move like RoboCop.
I feel like it either would have been Kevin Nash or Al Green in the role.
Right? Oh, my God, Al Green. And this is before the other guy started playing RoboCop, because RoboCop had not exploded into the franchise that it became with the TV series and all this other stuff. I can't remember. I keep wanting to say John Wesley Shipp was RoboCop in the television series, but I know he wasn't.
I think he had.
But it was a guy like that. You know what I mean? When you needed a non-Peter Weller
role. It was an actor with three names.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So yeah, at the time, I could see it. I think it probably was Peter Weller. And what's the rumor? How much did they pay him for this one-off appearance?
I have read that apparently they WCW paid him $150,000 for this one-night appearance.
Good God.
Which apparently did not make the locker room happy at the time.
Really? No kidding. What's the line, WCW, ladies and gentlemen? So that was that.
Andy Warhol, you can go to hell.
Andy, any memories you have of this great showing at Capital Combat?
Well, I was kind of hoping this would come up because I mentioned Kurt earlier, and we were tape trading and stuff back in 06, 07. Well, I don't know if Greg has seen this show. Like, you probably have because you're like a WCW diehard back then. There was a show I got from Kurt, and it was called WCW All Nighter. They filmed different segments with all the announcers together hanging out, having a party at Tony Schiavone's house. And he actually has a Capital Combat 90 poster in his house. And I went back and watched that today, and I'm like, yep, I wanted to make sure he's got a poster with RoboCop.
That is amazing.
The All Nighter, the WCW All Nighters were awesome. It would come on at like late night on the Superstation, on like late on a Friday or a Saturday night. It would literally last all night long of nothing but old WCW matches, and you'd have usually like, you know, the Brain or Schiavone, or sometimes it'd be like Larry Zbyszko and Schiavone, and it would they just riff in between showing these classic WCW matches, and so I would always look forward. I don't know how many of them they did. I feel like they only did maybe three or four, but I would always look forward to them so much, and like try to like plan plan my schedule around it, or at least get my VCR to record it so that I can watch it. Sadly, all my tapes of it are long since destroyed.
Yeah, I think I've seen maybe one, and it would have been the last one that they did, just because I came in so late. So that's something that, regrettably, I missed out on. But I can just imagine being a young fan back then and just having hours upon hours of just these matches that you hadn't seen, and high profile matches at that, just thrown together back to back, you know, in pre-DVD, pre-home video, certainly pre-network days. That stuff was hard to get a hold of.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. Well, it's a shame that there's no, you know, proper tag team between Sting and RoboCop. They never, you know, they never actually teamed up and had a match together. So that's a shame. Seems like a missed opportunity. But
yeah, RoboCop actually refused the angle because he wasn't going to be allowed to use his trusty handgun. So
He pulled the creative control clause. Okay.
Yep. God. The first of many instances in WCW.
Politicking son of a bitch, RoboCop. 1990 being the banner year that it was for WCW takes us into the Black Scorpion saga. I'm not sure what else to call it, which started like late summer. Sting was just coming back off of his injury. His knee had been surgically repaired, and now he's receiving messages from a character who says he's from Sting's past. A lot of speculation as to who this could be. Of course, all eyes and minds kind of turn to Jim Hellwig, the Ultimate Warrior, his former tag team partner. Couldn't possibly be him. He's employed by the WWF. But it had that air of mystery and intrigue around it.
And the Aftermags totally tried to sell us on it, too. They totally tried to play the Sting and Warrior card.
Right, exactly. So, I don't know, were you into this as it was unfolding, such as it was before the wheels really came off?
No.
Weren't feeling it, even as the youngster. Back then.
Even as a youngster, like, I would read the After mags religiously, and they were really trying to sell it as being the Ultimate Warrior. But even as a kid, I was like, why would Sting, or why would the Ultimate Warrior hate Sting? He would have no reason to do that. They like each other. They're friends. They both paint their faces. So, which was my logic at the time. So, I never bought into that it would be the Warrior, but there, and there was nobody else interesting that they could have had. And honestly, like, even as a kid, I was like, man, that's really corny. Like, and they had, like, the guy in the mask come out and do the magic tricks at the Clash of the Champions.
Yes.
Just terrible. And, like, I wanted to see Sting, you know, fight Sid and Barry Windham and Ric Flair and Lex Luger and all these other people on the roster. I didn't really want to see him fight an evil magician. So, no, at no point was I into the Black Scorpion.
Oh, the little stinger that you were a little Mark too, huh?
I was. Mark. Yes, I was ready to move on from the Black Scorpion storyline. I remember telling my dad at one point when we were watching the Clash of the Champions, or like at least the highlights of the Clash of the Champions or something. I was like, Daddy, that looks so fake.
Son, it is fake.
Yes, and he's like, my dad was probably like, well, now that I've told him that, he'll stop watching it.
Well, I wasn't going to go there, but since you brought up parenting, I feel like you must have either the best or the worst parents in the world for taking you to see RoboCop as your first movie. When I did the math, you said you're 32, yep. So you would have been
three.
Oh, when did RoboCop come out? 86?
87. 87. Summer of 87.
Yep. Okay, so you're three, possibly. Yeah, 3 years old.
Yep.
Yeah, I think we're all the same age, aren't we?
Yeah, I think so.
I love it. Yeah, I've got you guys by a few months, but yeah, I certainly wasn't. I saw a lot of age inappropriate movies growing up, but RoboCop I saw at daycare. I unfortunately didn't get to see it in the theater, but that was sort of an experience too.
it left an impression on me, but. You know, I don't know. I love my folks, man. Like I'm always like growing up in this area. My friends are often telling me about how their parents wouldn't let them watch all this stuff or listen to all this stuff. And I get it, but like, I don't know. To me, I never really had many restrictions on that when I was a kid, as long as my parents were watching it with me and could, you know, and I was never a kid that had a very difficult time separating fantasy from reality. So it was very easy for me to watch violent wrestling or RoboCop or whatever, and I never really wanted to go to school and be like, man, I want to, I don't know, create a cyborg and destroy the school or something, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say that kind of stuff didn't happen back then, but there was a degree of parents just not really giving a shit about stuff like, oh, it's just a dumb movie. Yeah, it's really violent, but it's just a dumb movie. I mean, I remember my parents. My mom didn't really care one way or another what I was watching for the most part. Again, as long as she'd seen it first. My dad was only really bothered by profanity or, you know, sexual elements.
Right.
But, I mean, a movie could be as violent as anything. And it's just so funny the way we perceive these adult situations so much differently.
I remember watching Highlander 3 The Final Dimension with my parents on video, and we've seen guys getting decapitated, we have seen war, but the minute that Christopher Lambert begins making love to the love interest and she disrobes, my mother's hands enveloped my young eyes and I was no longer allowed to see anything for the next few minutes of screen time, so... Certainly a curious bit of censoring there.
I'm sure she was just afraid you would be so repulsed by the sight of Christopher Lambert's lovemaking and exposure of, you know, bare chest potentially and probably corner of a butt.
There could be only one after all.
What are we trying to talk about? The Black Scorpion? This is appropriate for any conversation about and around the Black Scorpion gimmick. So it's Ole Anderson with a distorted, a really corny, like, voice distort. Like, it's so bad.
I mean, he did that so often, too. He did it with the Shockmaster, too.
I know. And it's so funny that, I mean, Sting was right when he told everyone watching at home that they're going to bring out the man who's going to shock the world. Boy, did he ever. I mean, he delivered on that promise. But I'm just like, wasn't Sting a little bit bothered by the fact that the Black Scorpion. This guy has the same voice as the Black Scorpion. I mean, I know he had unmasked the Black Scorpion by this point, but I mean, he should have been bothered by that, it seems like. And
he was just so trusting. Maybe he thought the Black Scorpion had reformed.
Well, you're right. He was that. So,
but you know, it's like such a corny voice, and like I almost feel like that's the lost gem in the entire Black Scorpion saga and in the Shockmaster saga, because everybody focuses on Fred Ottman falling for good reason, but people forget about the horrendous promo that is cut when he stands up and it's just Ole Anderson going,
"I am the Shockmaster. I'm gonna shock your world, Sid Vicious. Yeah."
And Sid completely no-selling it. And he's the only person, by the way, who tries to salvage that segment.
Yep.
He actually tries. My favorite part of that whole thing was, of course, everyone's breaking character. Ric Flair is almost in tears, but just the voice off screen of Stevie Ray, "Who is this motherfucker?" My favorite part is,
he fell on his fucking arse.
Fell on his fucking arse. just brilliant. I believe all of that is rather censored on the. I mean, it's hard to make out anyway. even you know, as it happened at the time, because again, this is off screen. They're uttering these things. They censor that on the network, regrettably. So, aww. But yeah, I'm sure you can find it on YouTube. But God, it's one of those things you hear about and really does live up to the hype.
Much more so than Black Scorpion.
Much more so than Black Scorpion, exactly. Which culminated at Starrcade 90. Andy, our favorite of the Starrcades almost. With the great tag team Memorial Cup. So, in any case, there's not much more to be said about the Black Scorpion, because aside from a few of those stunts, it was largely just boring and forgettable.
Uninteresting.
Yeah, exactly. But moving right along, the last thing that really comes to mind when I think of great Sting shit show moments was his match with Rick Steiner. And it was in 1999, so a good year for him, but not a good match. This was it? Please don't tell me it was Great American Bash, because we keep, it seems like, circling back to his performances at Great American Bash, and they're all pretty solid. So I'd hate to see this to be the one where the rails, it really goes off the rails, but I feel like it might have been.
It was.
Tell everyone about Rick Steiner's gimmick at the time.
I think it could be summed up as, "If you don't like me, bite me.
You want some? Come get some."
Yeah.
Which that ended up being pretty successful for another guy later on.
That is true. But I think that was the extent of Rick Steiner's character. At the time period, he not a lot of depth there. He turned heel.
He was the dog faced gremlin, and so he naturally had dogs that he could bring to, you know.
Yeah. So the match, I guess, goes backstage, or maybe after the match, post match, they're backstage, and Sting is straight up attacked by their Dobermans, weren't they?
I believe they were. I believe that Tony Schiavone was quite clear in his instant recognition of the dog breed.
And they just start chomping down on him, bite his arm, and kind of cut away. And that's kind of the final word on that. I don't think we ever. And
amazingly, the announcers are able, they're not that disturbed by it. They just move on to the next match.
Yeah, I guess they've seen enough at that point. Nothing really No surprises.
Fans, we'll be sure to get you an update on Sting being mauled to death a little bit later in the show. Now, here's the dog versus Brian Knobbs.
Oh, Christ. An obsession with dogs and dog gimmicks in 99 for some strange reason. Yeah. I wonder where that came from. It kind of feels like a Kevin Sullivan thing.
And
I don't
then,
know.
The World Who? Wrestling Federation even did the Kennel from Hell match that year with the dogs crapping at ringside.
Right. Oh, yeah. You got a point there. And that would have been Russo, right?
I feel like the Kennel for Hell might have been right after Russo, but maybe not. I don't know.
It was like borderline because I think it was like September 99, whatever show that was, I think.
Yeah, that could have been.
So yeah.
That could have been right at the tail end of Russo or just after. I don't know how long it was.
Was Eric still booking WCW in the summer when they did the Rick Steiner Sting match? Or was that like
In 99, I believe, yes, it still would have been Eric, but he was awfully checked out. I want to say it was July, August that he was done for the first time. So I don't know. Gosh, that's awfully close to his cutoff, too.
Yeah, well, I think Eric's tenure might have ended at the end of August, because at the beginning of August, wasn't it the beginning of August when he had that talent meeting backstage where he said if anybody has a problem with WCW or doesn't want to be here, they can leave right now? And Raven was like, I don't
want to
be here.
Raven left immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah, I believe so. And then Kevin Sullivan did get the book. He was probably still working with Bischoff, but I know I was hearing Kevin Sullivan's name in August, certainly in September, but he, of course, that was just a little transitional thing before Russo came in.
Right. Bill Bush and Kevin Sullivan, I think, were like the
That
bosses.
Sounds right. Yeah, that does sound familiar. They didn't do a half bad job, I didn't think, to be honest with you.
The only problem they ran into was the Sting heel turn didn't work because nobody liked Hogan.
Exactly.
So,
everyone cheered when he beat Hogan with the bat at Fall Brawl.
Hogan coming out and cutting promos like it's still like 1987.
Mm-hmm. Although, this may be another hidden gem. I'm glad you brought that up. It did lead to a tag match on Nitro that was, let me see if I can get it right. It was Hogan and Flair and I think probably Brett. Yeah, Hogan, Flair, and Brett versus Sting, the total package, because that's when Lex had come back from an injury and started doing total package gimmick, and DDP, six-man tag match on Nitro. It might have been the night after Fall Brawl 99, sometime in September anyway.
Yeah, that would have been around that time, yeah.
So it was like this just role reversals for like everybody, right? So the face team is Hogan, Flair, right? And like I said, Brett, who had largely been a heel throughout his WCW run. So if you had just done this match a year before, the roles would be totally opposite.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was, and they played it up a little bit actually. And it was kind of cool. And it really had that big match feel too, where it justified this is the main event. All these guys pretty much healthy, actually willing to work, not a bunch of bullshit, you know, interference type stuff that characterized basically every Nitro main event in 1998, where the bell would ring and 2 minutes in, it's a DQ.
Yeah, that might have been the same show also that kicked off with Sting cutting a heel promo on Ric Flair. They're both in the ring, and Sting cuts this kind of almost like not quite a shoot, like shootish promo where it's like, you know, when I came into the business in 1987 or whatever, you were the guy on top, and me and the Steiners and Lex Luger were coming up. Now it's 10 years later, and you're still in the same spot, Rick. Why won't you ever go away and make room for the new guys? And then Flair was just like, you know why? Because I'm Ric Flair and you're not. Woo!
Oh, my God. All right. Well, we haven't talked about the year 2000. And I don't really care to talk about the year 2000 for Sting.
You don't want to talk about the bloodbath match?
No, I don't want to talk about his matches with the Demon or with Vampiro.
Well, on that first Sting DVD, the best of, it's kind of a bunch of really random thrown together like TV matches. Even though they called it the best of Sting, like really the only,
it's really
but there is a couple near the end that I really like that were from 2000. I think he wrestles Booker T on TV, then he wrestled Jeff Jarrett. And those actually kind of impressed me a little bit for TV matches.
Yes.
You know?
Sting in 2000 was actually having some really good TV matches. The problem was his pay-per-view matches were all like horrific Russo gimmick matches. The exception being Spring Stampede, where they did the title tournament, if you remember. And he wrestled Booker T on that show. And when we went back and did a rewind with Ben Morris, maybe like a year or two ago, we all pictured that, circled that as our match of the night. It was actually really good, really competitive, fun match between Sting and Booker T. And he would also have really good matches that year with like the Natural Born Thrillers later in that year on Thunder, of all places, because I remember he let – I thought it was so cool because WCW brought the ramp back that connected to the ring. And Sting actually let the Jindrak and what's his name, O'Hare, do the double beel from the floor up over the top rope and into the ring to him, and just that was pretty cool. So he was having some good TV matches, but you know he was also getting set on fire and falling off the top of the arena stuff.
Yeah, that runway was a pretty cool and very WCW-esque feature. I forgot that they brought that back at towards the end there. And I'll be honest, I don't remember any of his work with the Natural Born Thrillers, who are sort of high on my list of tag teams that or stables, really, that never quite got their due.
Yeah. Above average Mike Sanders. As
yep. I was sort of a mark for him. I liked him as that commissioner role. But wow, maybe I just stopped watching Thunder at that point, which why would anyone stop watching Thunder?
I can't imagine. but I remember distinctly they did a double beel from the floor up over the top rope to Sting, and he took the bump, and I was like, man, that's really cool that a dude would take that bump, because that's pretty dangerous kind of spot for a guy at his, you know, he wasn't like an old man at that point, but he was, you know, he was getting towards the end of his peak athletic years.
His 40s. Yeah, he would have been early 40s at the time, I feel like.
Yeah. So, you know, pretty impressive there, and like, you know, we talked a little bit about the Vampiro feud and that being, you know, not the, shall we say, not the the highlight of the Stinger's career. But I really thought that, you know, if they had given him more like traditional wrestling feuds that year, that it would have worked out better, because he was still good in the ring. You know, he wasn't going to carry guys to great matches, but he was still good enough to keep up with anybody in the ring. But he was stuck doing like really weird gimmick feuds and stuff. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
and the Jarrett stuff was good. You're right, Andy. I had forgotten about their feud in the second half of 2000. That was some good work.
Speaking of him being stuck in kind of weird feuds, it almost seemed to me like when I was watching that Sting video, the one match, I think it might have been with Booker T, like one of those matches ended with Vampiro coming out. And his buddy, he was teamed up with the Demon. He came out, and I think it must have been Booker T, because they hung up. I think Sting was, like, suspended, hanging by his feet, and they're, like, beating him up. And then I think somebody else gets, can't remember who it was, but one of them got, like, locked in the Demon's, like, little Iron Maiden thing with the spikes, like the Kiss thing. And
right.
And it totally seemed like Russo was ripping himself off. That's my point I was trying to make, is that Russo was ripping himself off, because it felt like where they set Kane, set the Undertaker on fire And it was pretty much like they pretty much plugged in Sting into the Undertaker role, and then Vampiro was the Kane character.
And I would be willing to bet money that that's exactly how Russo thought about it.
Yeah, that was, it's like I said, Russo was a one-trick pony. And if he did it once, he would do it again. It's sort of his greatest hits.
One thing that was brought to mind real quick when Andy, you brought up the demon, Dale Torborg. Nobody remembers this, but there was an episode of Thunder that had one of my favorite commentary exchanges of all time. Maybe somebody remembers this, probably not, but it was a random match with Dale Torborg, the demon, versus somebody, and I don't remember who he was wrestling, it doesn't matter. And he gave him a move, like a rock bottom type move or something, and like put him in like as I remember it, what looked like the Anaconda Vice that CM Punk would later use in his wrestling career. Anyway, he applies this move, and of course Tony's like, he got him with the move or whatever. And then and Stevie Ray, who was on color commentary, said, he got him with the Shudamaki. and Tony Schiavone like skips a beat and there's just silence. And he goes, He sure did, Stevie.
You see, this is why we've got to get Thunder on the network. Post-haste. I'm inclined to start a petition. I could probably get somewhere in the neighborhood of like 9 signatures, I'm betting.
I would sign it in a heartbeat.
There you go. Yeah.
The three of us could sign it, and then the three of us could come up with false identities and sign it again.
Right. So we could multiply that by at least 3, I think.
You know, speaking of Thunder, we haven't mentioned this before on the show, but Tim and I had been thinking about this show for like months, like all summer. We've been brainstorming like ideas for a name because it's really hard to come up with a name because you don't want to take something that somebody else has already taken. And how do you know it's already used? So you have to do Google searches. We both were talking about Thunder, and I thought of a name, and I thought it was perfect. Thunder Buddies. Oh, well, then I looked up, I think on like iTunes, and somebody's already using Thunder Buddies. And I was so crushed because it's like Oklahoma City Thunder. And I was like,
who cares about that?
Almost the name of our podcast. Yeah. It's regrettably already taken. Either of you gentlemen have anything else you want to get into on the man called Sting? Anything we've overlooked, memories, moments, highlights, lowlights?
I don't want to keep you guys up for, you know, an eternity talking about this stuff, but I could talk about Sting all day long, how much he's meant to me personally. As a kid, I mean, he was truly one of my inspirations when I was a kid. Him and Bret Hart were like the two wrestlers who, when things were going bad for me in life, I could watch them and they would take me away out of my whatever troubles I was going through as a young boy. Or even as an adult, when I would discover things such as when Andy illuminated me and brought to mind the phenomenon in pop culture that was Sting ass.
Oh, God. <don't.
laughs> Right. So we'll never live down the Cruise World Order ass off tournament, which has been well documented on this show. Just a reminder, Cruise World Order was a live journal spinoff of Scott Keith's original live journal. If that statement isn't enough of a pussy magnet by itself. Yeah, we had the tournament. Sting made a really good showing. And I should mention the other night I watched a Sting versus Ron Simmons match.
Oh.
It was about all the ass I could handle, y'all. It was
that is a lot of ass for one match.
It was a lot of ass. And if you want to know why Ron Simmons won that tournament, watch that match, because 1991, this might have been 1990, was, I mean, we're talking peak Ron Simmons ass. It was unbelievable.
And both guys wore like bright neon tights, and both guys hiked their tights up to their stomachs like Shawn Michaels did in 1993 for some reason.
Exactly right. It's unreal.
That's where that actually came from, because I think somebody shared the LiveJournal link on Facebook. That was my original post. I think I said something about Shawn Michaels having the Shawn Michaels butt because he had the trunks right. hiked up. So I think that's what started it.
That was the question, whether Shawn Michaels had Sting ass or if Shawn Michaels simply hiked his tights up so high that it looked like he had Sting ass. It was just the illusion. That was the controversy.
Brock responded with the post everyone was waiting for, the "What in the hell is a Sting ass?" Oh. Good Lord.
Wow.
But no, in all seriousness, I do really have a strong attachment to Sting because he's been my second favorite. He was my favorite wrestler early on in life, and he's been my second favorite wrestler ever since I discovered the Hitman. And, you know, it's those two guys kind of like created my really emotional attachment to wrestling. They kept me occupied when I was bored. They uplifted me when I was, you know, down and out or whatever. So Sting was really a big part of wrestling history and a big part of particularly in the Southeast. Sting has always been such a big deal because I think for kids of my age that grew up down here, he was a superhero to us in the way that that Hulk Hogan might have been for people the rest of the country. Or, you know, I mean, even to the point where if you watch Nitro in 98, there's a match between Sting and Goldberg when Goldberg was at his hottest. And if you listen, and this is when Sting was like Wolfpack Sting, so he's like lame Sting. But if you watch that match, the crowd was cheering Sting over Goldberg.
Yeah, and that never happened in 98 because Goldberg was supremely over. Not just hype over, not just we're going to put this guy out here and tell the fans what we want them to think. He got organically over.
Yep.
And nobody ever cheered for any of Goldberg's opponents. I mean, he certainly had a lot of squashes, but even when he was going up against legit guys and having real matches, it was 100% in Goldberg's favor. There was no split crowd. There was no, you know, rooting for the other guy. And you're right. You put him up against Sting and people were not having it. They're like, nope. So, all right. Well, Andy, anything else on Sting that you want to get into that we haven't touched on? I think I've said my piece. And Greg, I think you've kind of helped me turn a corner here. So I do appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely, man. I feel like you know, he's not ever going to be everybody's favorite. I think there's a lot of emotion involved in why he's one of my favorites, but I also think that he gets underrated a lot of times in online circles for the things that he did really, really well, like his timing and understanding how there's a reason why he got cheered over everybody he ever wrestled and never got booed. Unlike somebody that you hear, by the way, no knock on the guy who's a great wrestler. Everybody says Steamboat was the ultimate babyface. But if you watch a lot of Steamboat matches, he got booed a lot. I mean, sure. He got booed every time he wrestled Ric Flair pretty much from 1989 on. Sting never got booed against Ric Flair. So it's just cool to be able to talk about. I really appreciate you guys letting me come on because it's awesome to talk about Sting and finally get to say why I, you know, have always had such a big attachment for him.
No doubt. All right. Well, Andy, do you like Sting more or less after this show? Like I said, I think I like him a little bit more now. What about you, sir?
Yep. I've got to agree.
Excellent. Well, I think that about wraps it up. And Greg, I mean, you said you could talk for days on end about Sting. So I won't preclude the possibility of us. Maybe we could revisit this, do a sequel. I'm sure, like, you know, I always think of stuff that I wish I had said during the show days later. Mm-hmm. And I think we can all say the same. So history is any indicator, that will be the case. And who knows, maybe we can do this again. I'd be up for it.
Absolutely. And if you guys also want to have me on for the Das Wunderkind Alex Wright episode, happy to do that as well.
I don't know. There might be a lot of competition for that. I mean, it could turn into a 16-man booth quite easily.
Oh, and you guys, whether I'm a part of it, you guys have to do an episode just on the little, like, pick me character videos on the WCW Nitro and Thunder video games.
Oh my God, I know exactly what you're talking about. I have both those games. I think I still have them. Has somebody put those on YouTube, I hope?
They have to have, because they're so good. They're so amazing. Yeah. The game's horrible, but they're worth it for these bizarre video things.
And the guys like start like cutting promos on each other too. Nash is like really, wasn't he like really sort of lackadaisical about the whole thing?
Yeah, like, he's just like, pick come me. On, pick Hogan, yeah, come on, Savage. Pick me. Come on, you know you want to, pick me. Yep. And then you got Alex Wright, who has he has two different video clips to play, one of them in German, where it's all just him speaking in German, and then the other one where he's like, hello, here is Alex Wright. And and then there's like Macho Man has, of course, just absolute batshit insane Macho Man stuff. You know, like Piper's, I remember being really weird too.
He goes after Nash or something. It's like he almost you picture these guys lined up to record their promo for the Thunder PlayStation video game, and Nash must have gone right before Piper, and it just touched a nerve because he's like, Nash, don't pick me. Well, pick me because I'm the hot Scott Ball.
Yeah, and he says, I remember him saying something like, I'll trash Nash.
Yeah, something like that. DDP's is a soliloquy. It just keeps going. I don't remember any of the content of it. I just remember it being the longest one by far. And you're like, Jesus God, I'm, you know, I'm trying to get out of this now. He's like telling you his life story in this little promo piece for the video game.
I'm just saying, I feel like you guys could get an episode out of analyzing each of those videos one by one.
Yeah, we'll have to play them on the show.
Yes.
All of them. And there's something like, what, 64 guys that are playable on those games?
Yeah, like La Parca and...
All the luchadors, yeah.
Super Colo.
El Dandy, of course.
Oh my God. Of course, the Dandy.
I was really missing out because I played the Nintendo 64 games more.
Right, you played the good ones, yeah.
You played the good ones. You weren't missing anything, man. You were just missing the amazing videos because the actual games were so bad on the PlayStation. So bad.
Shite. And yet I played them so much, like every night, constantly.
Tim, do you remember how bad the commentary was?
Power bomb.
The power bomb. The power for any move you did.
Which, by the way, everyone had like the same basic move set, except for each guy had, I want to say, three signature moves. So not a whole lot of variation. And,
you'd play WCW versus NWO Revenge, and everybody would have like all these custom distinct move sets, and then you'd go and play Nitro and Thunder, and it was like playing, I don't know, tag team wrestling from the NES or something.
You could do Frankensteiners with Hollywood Hogan, and that was quite entertaining. You could do like press slams with Rey Mysterio. So put him up against the giant and just have Ray chuck the giant right over the top rope.
With undoubtedly the power bomb.
Yes. I think they actually changed it in Thunder where only the smaller wrestlers could do the Hurricanrana and head scissors, and the bigger guys did power bombs and press slams and stuff. But in Nitro, it was just total free-for-all the first game. I can't believe how much I actually remember about this shite game from back in the day.
And Andy, I'm telling you, this will be a life-changing experience for you when you see these videos.
I vaguely remember it because my neighbor had a PlayStation, and wasn't those games were more like almost like motion capture, like they looked like the wrestlers, but the 64 games were kind of like blocky characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
There's one thing I wanted to bring up that was mentioned in the chat that we had before we set the show up that I wanted to bring up on the air. And that is talking about Sting. Sting had a career after WCW, as many know. He was in a promotion that shares many similarities with WCW called Total Nonstop Action Wrestling.
I've never heard of it. What are they known for?
They are known for actually, they're not known. They're just not known.
Oh, okay.
But the Hollywood Hulk Hogan even. Whoever Hollywood Hulk Hogan is didn't go there, but Hollywood Hulk Hogan went there for a period of time and feuded with man called Sting. And during this time, during this era, there was created what I consider to be one of the greatest characters in wrestling history, only known to me and my friend Corey as TNA Hogan. And TNA Hogan is a character that exists outside the greater traditional Hulkamania universe. You know, you had your Hulk Hogan, and you had your Hollywood Hogan, and then you had your Hollywood Hulk Hogan in 2002, which is Nick's favorite. But TNA Hogan was a separate character entirely, a Hulk Hogan who would wear skin-tight black jeans with Air Jordans, that were bright white and bright red, and he would come to the ring with his traditional do-rag and black t-shirt and black sunglasses look, and he would attempt to use modern-day, what he believed to be modern-day street lingo to try to sound urban, I suppose. And so he would use terminology that had gone out of style years before. He would come out wearing, you know, FUBU attire and things like that. Well, in the midst of his feud with Sting, he became very upset with some of the comments that Sting had made about him, about how Hulk Hogan was a backstabber and a liar. And Hogan, he had about had enough of this. And he cut a promo in the ring one night on Impact, and he proceeded to explain that, well, you know, dude, Sting thinks he's been hanging and banging with me for enough years, brother. Well, listen, I've hung and bung with all of them, and the Stinger's been like this his whole career, a crybaby, dude. Now, why don't you put that in your Stinger pipe and smoke it, brother? And the Stinger pipe promo, as I later because see, CM Punk had the pipe bomb,
the pipe Hulk bomb, Hogan, yeah.
TNA Hogan had the Stinger pipe bomb, as I call it. So. That I wanted to bring that up on the show for the record so that people can perhaps remember, if they were watching TNA in those days, the glory that was put it in your Stinger pipe and smoke it, brother.
Sounds like it's worth it for the expression hung and bung. Hung and bung. Sounds like a early 90s WCW tag team.
So, Marcus Alexander Bagwell.
Yeah, he was bung. Yeah.
Hung and bung.
Yeah. And Scorpio was hung, I think.
Oh. Okay. Oh, Lord.
Yeah, that I do vaguely recall that now that you mention it. So this would be the new 52 Hogan, essentially.
Yes, very much the new 52, edgy and hip Hogan. Yes,
he's been rebooted.
He also came out in they were in Dallas, Texas, I think, or Fort Worth, somewhere in Texas, for a live Impact, and he came out and he cut a promo where inexplicably he says, "You know, it's always good to come here to Texas." Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can't even get it out of my God. It's like, I remember I was watching it with my friend and his young son, and his young son thought we had just lost our minds because we were laughing so hard. We fell onto the floor of my apartment laughing and pounding our fists into the ground because of the yah, yah, yah. And the crowd didn't react at all. And Hogan looked around and just continued with the promo.
That's tremendous. Talk about the many faces of Sting. This is Joker Sting.
Yes, during this Joker time period. Sting. Yeah. He didn't much care for Commissioner Gordon's plans, and so
I think that about does it. So, again, we may revisit this in the future if we have occasion. Greg, tell the folks listening at home where they can find you on Place to Be Nation and any endeavors that you participate in.
We, the Hard Traveling Fanboys, we can be found every week here on Place to Be Nation Pop. The Pop feed is awesome. You've got the Sellers Point podcast. You've got Conversation Comics. You've got Geek and Sassy, a brand new podcast on Place to Be Nation Pop. You've got Glenn Butler's podcast, Our Spectacular. You've got Lucha Undead, and you've got us coming to you every week. And we've got a litany of projects coming up, of which Tim will be a part in the future. We've got a new series looking at the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Tim is going to join us to talk about Captain America in a few months. That'll be cool. This month, we're doing Walking Dead Month at Place to Be Nation Pop. We're looking at the comics, the video games, the TV show, the phenomenon that is The Walking Dead, the good, the bad, everything in between. And then we've got Ben Morse coming on next month to talk a little Marvel video game action. So be on the lookout for that.
And that episode will have dropped by the time this one has, depending on when this goes up. But I'm sure that you being a weekly show, you'll have a few more in the can. So, Greg, I want to thank you for taking the time. Sure do appreciate it. Had a lot of fun here tonight. Andy, as always, it has been a genuine pleasure. So on that note, for Andy Helene, I'm Tim Capel. We are desperately out of time. Tonight on Movies for Guys Who Like Movies, it's Highlander 3, The Shittening. Don't go anywhere. Don't touch that dial. We'll be back next month for more Survey Says.
Bitches leave.